You knew Hope. Can you know Hope? Can you talk about her significance in what she did in these last 20 seconds?
I am not surprised at all that Hope will have the courage in that moment to make that call and do what she had to do. She is the only daughter of a loving couple that just adore her. And she has been working in multiple issues on behalf of people with disabilities, just like her father.
I'm going to have
thank you so much for your participation
in today's show. Patricia Torres-Ray, former Minnesota senator, worked closely with Minnesota former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and State Senator John Hoffman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and around the world at kfai.org.
Today on Mini Culture Presents, we are going to be airing one of my favorite audio documentaries of all time, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening, from Professor David Hendy of the University of Sussex. It is a six-part series. This is an expanded version that we're going to be hearing today, and we will be airing part one for the full hour. So prick up your ears and enjoy.
What if history had a soundtrack? What would it tell us about ourselves? This BBC radio series was made in collaboration with the British Library Sound Archive. It explores the human dramas that have revolved around sound at various points in the last 100,000 years, allowing us to think in fresh ways about the meaning of our collective past. Noise, A Human History, Prehistoric Voice Prints.
Noise, A Human History, Echoes in the Dark.
In the middle of a modern metropolis such as New York, you're surrounded, bombarded even, by all the sounds of 21st century life. Wherever there are people and machines, there's noise. We try hard to shut it out or ignore it, and we assume the past was much quieter. But over the next 30 programmes, I want to challenge this. I want to tell the story of the extraordinary sounds we've made since we first became human. It's a story not just about music or talking, but sound and what it communicates in all its forms. We'll meet African drummers, church bells, the baying crowds of ancient Rome, medieval carnivals, eavesdropping servants, the music of American slaves, the roar of the Industrial Revolution, the din of war, and the chatter of 24-hour media. I want to turn up the volume of the past so that through sound, we make sense of the struggles and emotions of history in a new way. And I want to begin tens of thousands of years ago with an echoing cave. I'm just a few steps inside a cave at Arcy-sur-Cure in Burgundy in France, and it's here that we find some evidence of intriguing human activity having taken place in Europe between 40 and 20,000 years ago. I'm not alone. Just ahead of me, as we move deeper into the cave, is the French musicologist Yegor Reznikov. What you can hear is him pausing at various recesses and creating a rumbling echo, which sounds almost like the growling of some sort of animal, a bison or a wolf. We've now come to one of the main chambers of the cave, and as you can hear, Yegor Reznikov is unleashing the full force of his voice. What we're experiencing in this part of the cave is a cacophony of echoes, each one lasting long enough to merge with the next and create a kind of wall of sound.
Yeah. We might think of a cave as a peaceful place, but put humans into the equation and it can become quite unnervingly noisy. If we whisper or hum or speak or sing, the cave whispers or hums, talks and sings back to us. It's as if the cave is alive.
Yegor Reznikov is one of several archaeologists who've tried an intriguing experiment. Moving slowly and in total darkness along the narrower passages of caves like Arsi-Sukur, they've used their voices as a kind of sonar, sending out a pulse of sound, then listening out for any unusually resonant response. When they felt the sound around them changing, they turned on their torches. And at that precise point, they often saw on the wall or ceiling a small dot of red ochre, or a painted pattern of lines, a negative handprint, sometimes even a picture of an animal. At one place in the cave of Arsi-Sur-Cur itself, there's a brilliant example of this. I'm near the bottom of the main hall, where each sound might provoke up to 7 echoes. And looking around, we can see several mammoths, some bears, a rhinoceros or two, some fish, some sort of big cat, and on the floor, the delicate outlines of a bird. Igor Reznikov was the first person to map in detail this stunning coincidence of resonance and art, and he reckons about 80% of the images are in spots where the acoustics are particularly unusual. Coming back out of the cave, it seems strange that the prehistoric artists didn't paint here, near the entrance, where there's much more light. Something drew them to the darkest, deepest, most inaccessible chambers. And even prehistoric art that's been found outside caves is sometimes located in the most inconvenient places, high on canyon walls or on cliff faces. And it's often crowded onto some surfaces, while other rocks nearby have been left completely blank. At Horseshoe Canyon in Utah and Hieroglyph Canyon in Arizona, experimental recordings have shown that rock paintings of people and sheep and deer are in exactly the same places where echoes are strongest or sound travels furthest. This connection between sound and image just keeps cropping up. Whoever created this art seems to have chosen acoustically interesting spaces, as if mesmerised by echoes. So what exactly is going on? One clue has emerged by accident in Cambridge, where a group of researchers were recently exploring the distant origins of music. They knew that humans were making musical bone flutes about 36,000 years ago. But what about before that? Could stone objects have been used to make music? The researchers tried striking flints, and as they sat in a courtyard, coaxing an intriguing array of sounds from the stones, they heard a high-pitched flutter, a bird nearby, flying away. The sound of the flint being struck had bounced off the parallel walls of the courtyard in such a way as to cause what acoustic experts call a flutter echo. Despite there being a scientific explanation, one of the researchers admitted the illusion was quite unearthly, as if the tapping had suddenly awoken some real yet invisible entity, an avian spirit. This notion that animal spirits can be brought to life through sound would have made sense back here, in a world with no scientific understanding of sound waves and reverberation. In a prehistoric cave, a clap bounces back in a series of overlapping echoes, and it's as if the animals painted on the walls start galloping,
The sound of hooves really does seem to be coming from deep within the walls themselves. And for the people who first entered this cave, echoes would surely have been like new sounds coming from inside the rock, something speaking back to them, something supernatural.
Some Native American peoples have long believed that witches live among the rocks, taking great delight in repeating the words of passers-by. The Cherokee even have names for rocks that talk. In southern Africa, the San Bush people paint images on rocks of figures crawling out of the cracks, as if emerging from a teeming spirit world just behind the surface. It's hard to resist the thought that for much of history, and perhaps for prehistory, anywhere that echoed has been regarded as a sacred place full of spirits. A recording from 1960 at the British Library Sand Archive of a curing dance being performed in Botswana. The man whose voice we hear now and then is in a trance state, attempting to contact the supernatural. The San who perform this ritual also make stunning rock paintings of monsters, fish, eels, turtles, and humans dancing in a trance. It's possible these paintings represent the visions of those in a trance state, the creatures witnessed when the veil between this world and the next is lifted. As we might expect, the images are often found on resonant surfaces, walls that seem, from the sound they make, to be inhabited, which act, perhaps, as gateways to the spiritual realm. So perhaps our prehistoric ancestors back at the cave at Arcy-sur-Cure weren't just bemused by the strange echoes stirred up by their presence. Perhaps they went there to actively invoke a spirit world, to be in dialogue with it, tapping flints to set off fluttering echoes, or even hitting a pillar of rock. A Kabiye orchestra from Togo playing the Pichanchalasi lithophone, or musical stone. We can hear gong rocks in Namibia and ringing rocks in southern India, Scandinavia and North America. The sound of the lithophone is ubiquitous, and since it probably has been for most of human history, it raises the possibility of sounds which we might call music being created thousands of years ago in prehistoric caves. I've come to a part of the cave at Arcy-sur-Cure called the Dance Hall. It's called that because not long after it was discovered, glittering balls were sometimes held here. There's a stalagmite, and it's covered with our familiar tag of sonic significance, that red ochre. I don't touch it now, but I can certainly imagine using it as a chime. In caves across Europe, there are rock pillars just like this one, decorated with red dots and bearing all the marks of being repeatedly hit. Some of the very oldest bone flutes found in the Pyrenees were next to a decorated pillar. But prehistoric people didn't really need to invent bone pipes in order to make music in here. They already had these stone pillars to hit, their own voices, and of course the wonderful resonance of the caves or rock shelters themselves. Here in the dark, with only the flickering half-light of their lamps or tapers, the atmosphere would surely have been perfect for rituals or celebrations, for music and singing, for summoning the supernatural. Ancestors must have wanted to keep making sound, if only to keep the conversation with the spirit world going. Over time, new sounds, tonal effects, notes, rhythms would have been discovered. They were tried out, they echoed back, they were copied, altered, replayed thousands of times over and over again. And eventually, from rough-and-ready dabbling, something we'd recognise as a musical performance or a formal ceremony would have emerged. Of course, all this chanting and playing wasn't just about communicating with a spirit world. Often, it was about communication between living people in this world.
Noise. A human history. The beat of drums.
That was Nana Bafour Chiramateng playing the talking drum, which is basically a tree trunk hollowed out and struck with two sticks, one held in each hand.
And you know, the talking drummer is described as a divine drummer. We call it Odumankuma Chirema. Ochirema is a drummer.
And the talking drum has a special place here in Ghana, in fact, throughout West Africa, especially in the dank, dark, equatorial rainforest, where it's always been impossible to see very far, and the only way to communicate really is through sound. Just as Morse code uses a series of dots and dashes, the talking drum has used a mixture of high and low tones, depending on where the drum is hit. And the precise combination of these tones makes up its message. For thousands of years, no one in the world could communicate as far or as fast as Africans with their talking drums. It's a tradition that tells us not just about communication, it helps us travel back in time to reveal the vital role of sound, and in particular of rhythm, in human evolution. We're hearing one of the great treasures of the British Library's sound archive. This scratchy wax cylinder recording was made in 1921 by Captain Robert Sutherland Rattray, a British colonial administrator who lived among the Ashanti people of Ghana. Before Rattray, slave traders and missionaries who'd heard these talking drums interpreted them as a call to fight, or some hellish pagan custom, or immoral merrymaking. In any case, they didn't want to inquire much further. By the 1920s and 30s, however, Captain Rattray was part of a new generation of more enlightened settlers. Another member of this invading Western tribe was a missionary called Roger Clark, based among the Tumba near the Congo River. After listening with the help of local translators, he thought he'd cracked the secret code. So, for example, a simple call to fight would become something like this.
Make the drum strong. Strengthen your legs. Spear, shaft and head, and the noise of moving feet. Think not to run away.
And a farewell to the sun in the evening would become...
Shining sun, who has made a dwelling in the sky, who has gone to concourse of counsel. All morning, all day, evening comes. You are going, goodbye.
All richly poetic, but why so long-winded? The answer came a few years later from another missionary, John Carrington. He noticed that when everything was reduced to two-tone beats, there was lots of potential for confusion. For instance, a double stroke on the high-tone lip of the drum could mean moon, birdfowl, a kind of fish, and countless other things. But Carrington realised that when extra phrases were added, the moon looks down at the earth, the fowl, the little one that says kyokyo, ambiguity evaporated. So the drumming wasn't really signalling, but a whole language, like conversation, chatty, informal, jokey, taking turns. And the process of talking is almost always as important as what's actually being talked about. When it works, all that back-and-forth rhythm, with the subtle shifts in tone, weaves a special kind of magic, getting us in tune with each other. This has been the pattern throughout history and across cultures.
Da 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 da.
We're hearing what linguists call infant-directed speech, that sing-song voice caregivers use when chatting to their babies. This sheer emotional expressiveness clearly counts for much more than what's being said. The melody is the message. Such musical qualities are so deeply embedded, so universal, that they give a strong hint about the past. That if we go back several million years to a point before we had language or even music, we might find that the very first proto-humans to leave Africa had something else instead, a kind of sing-song utterance that was a curious mix of both language and music. Vervet monkeys recorded in Kenya. They have a thrilling range of alarm calls. Calls communicating precise information about the predator spotted nearby. In this case, about a leopard and an eagle. These Gelada monkeys' calls are less distinctive. But what their communication lacks in data, it more than makes up for with melody, which is quite complex and rhythmic. Gibbons performing a kind of duet. It's with apes and monkeys that we all shared a common ancestor several million years ago. So it's reasonable to assume that what we're hearing are very roughly the kinds of sounds our own proto-human ancestors would also have been making. These are the Bayaka pygmies of the rainforests of the Central African Republic in a recording held at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. The men are chanting and drumming as they get ready for a net hunt, while choirs of women weave shimmering webs of polyphonic sound to entice the forest spirits to dance and bless the hunt. Those dressed as the spirits also harangue the hunters in their falsetto voices when their rhythms don't quite come together. Sing better, drum better, and you will eat tomorrow. There's lots of information in these sounds, but what's being created is coordination and mutual trust, the individual giving way to the group. What we're also hearing is entrainment, when different rhythms start to interact and then synchronize. It's listening to music and starting to tap our feet in time. It's a group of soldiers adjusting their pace to march in unison. It's an individual bodily rhythm being subsumed into a collective rhythm. It's impossible to tell the difference between performer and listener, simply because the distinction doesn't really exist. Besides, there are the universal rhythms, the beat of a heart, the in and out of breathing, the steady gait of walking, biorhythms that continued to shape the undulating patterns of music and language, even when our distant ancestors had left the rainforests of Africa and moved into the open savannas beyond. This wet and windy stretch of British coastline might seem a far cry from the heat and dust of the African savanna, but 800,000 or 900,000 years ago, southern Britain was the kind of place that's been described as a northern latitude Serengeti. And coastal erosion in the Norfolk village of Haysborough has recently unearthed the fossilised remains of butchered hyenas and bison and mammoths, alongside 80 or so flint tools. Evidence, in other words, of a thriving community of early humans, among the very first to settle in northern Europe. Those most skilled in conveying their own feelings and in reading the feelings of others would have been the most useful members of the Haysborough community. Predicting and manipulating the behaviour of others gives one a big evolutionary advantage. Something with the quality of music might well have been a safer evolutionary bet than using words. Music's different. its meaning is helpfully vague. If an argument's brewing, it's often better not to say anything and just lose one's differences in singing or dancing. It's still several hundred thousand years before humans were capable of the coded language of talking drums. But those early humans in Haysborough give us tiny hints of the vital role that was going to be played by rhythm in driving forward our evolution. Rhythm remains deeply rooted, a universal feature of human-made sound. It's why we still hear beguiling similarities in music from very different parts of the world, and why we hear the same underlying melodies at work in completely different languages. But over the past million years, as we spread further and further across the world, our cultures also inevitably drifted apart as we adapted to the different habitats in which we lived. We like to think of ourselves as having risen above nature, but the natural wilderness remains embedded in the sounds we make to this day.
And you are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Radio Without Boundaries. Noise, a human history of sound and listening, will continue right after these messages. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members, just like you, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Melissa Farrick returns to the Cedar Cultural Center on Tuesday, June 18, with special guest Rose Cousins. Melissa Farrick has been writing, recording, and performing music for over 30 years, bringing a wide range of experiences to the stage. Canadian folk pop singer-songwriter Rose Cousins opens the evening with selections from her newly released Conditions of Love, Volume 1. Details and tickets at thecedar.org.
They tried to stone us and they tried to drown us, and it became an international incident at the time.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Harry Hurley. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran and spent 4 years on an aircraft carrier, the USS Independence, during the Vietnam War. I had some PTSD from experiences in the service. One of the ports we went to was Istanbul, Turkey. There were 400 Turks that were demonstrating against Americans because they didn't think the United States should be involved in the Vietnam War. And four of us got attacked by 400 Turks. And it took many years for me to be able to address that. I get flashbacks of the time when I was drowning and realized that I needed help for it. Then I started using other services, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and they helped me get over that. It's a scientifically proven way to get a person from the fight or flight, which is in the back of your brain, to the front part of your brain, which is this is what's going on right now. You're not in danger from what happened 30 years ago. As long as you stay in the present, you'll be okay, and then you can work on the future.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Dean Wareham live at the Turf Club on Thursday, June 19th. Dean Wareham, founding member of Galaxy 500, Luna, and half of Dean and Britta, is touring with his latest solo album, You Were the Ones I Had to Betray. Dean has reteamed with Galaxy 500 producer Kramer to produce this slowcore dream pop release. Opening the show, avant-garde artist Chris Forsythe. More information on Dean Wareham with Chris Forsythe at the Turf Club, available at the First Avenue website, first-avenue.com.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2025 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information is online at bushfoundation.org.
Welcome back to the BBC series Noise, A Human History.
Noise, A Human History. The Singing Wilderness.
One of the less well-known wonders of the natural world is Burntside Lake in the northern woods of Minnesota. There's a small cove bordered with willow, birch, weathered pine, juniper. And in this idyllic setting, facing out across the lake, a small wooden cabin, built in 1956 by the American conservationist Sigurd Olsen. He called his private retreat Listening Point, a place where he said he could hear all that was worth listening for. Here, more than any other place, there were no distracting sights or sounds. For Olsen, the essence of any wild place was its silence. But was Olsen right? Is silence really the essence of the world's wild places? Nature itself can be immensely noisy. Evergreen forests, for example, give out a low, breathy whistle. If the wind gets up, they'll seethe and roar and creak as branches rub together and the needles twist. A downpour in an African rainforest. The great collector of natural sounds, Bernie Kraus, describes being caught one afternoon as he set up his equipment. The first dense wall of water falling like a freight train approaching. A few moments later, the melodic drips on the leaves, the odd splash on the ground, and finally, as the storm recedes, insects beginning to stridulate. Just a few at first, then in their thousands, and countless exotic birds starting to call out to one another, their cries reverberating as if in a giant cathedral. At moments like this, the forest is wide awake. But really, it was never fully asleep. Which is why, when the young anthropologist Colin Turnbull first went into Congo's Ituri forest in the 1950s, he didn't find the silence he'd read about in textbooks.
The shrill trumpeting of an elephant, or the sickening cough of a leopard, or the 101 sounds that can be mistaken for it. At night, in the honey season, you hear a weird, long, drawn-out, soulful cry high up in the trees. It seems to go on, and you wonder what kind of creature can cry for so long without taking breath. Then, in the early morning, comes the pathetic cry of the pigeon, a plaintive cooing that slides from one note down to the next until it dies away in a soft, sad little moan.
Even Sigurd Olsen, smoking his pipe in the quiet of Burntside Lake, wrote of the singing wilderness. It's evening, and the Busavi, or Kaluli people of Papua New Guinea, are singing a gisalo in the darkness of the longhouse deep in the forest. These sounds are intricately connected with the everyday sounds of the forest. Birds, insects, trees, water flowing, rain pouring. These are what the Kaluli sing with and to and about. The same densely sensual series of overlapping sounds also comes through when they're cutting trees or making sago. The whooping and whistling and singing interlocks with the ambient noise, creating a polyphony. It copies the insects and frogs and cicadas in the nearby bush and echoes back to them. These recordings were made more than 30 years ago by the American anthropologist Steve Felt. who, perhaps more than anyone else, has helped us understand the place of sound in the culture of rainforest people, such as the Kaluli. They have, for instance, completely different phrases for bird songs heard at ground level and those above, those heard nearby and those in the distance. Show them a picture of a bird and they'll imitate the sound before naming it. Ask them for the bird's name and they won't tell you what it looks like. They'll say, it sounds like this. We could go almost anywhere in the more remote areas of the world, and we'd track down equally impressive examples. To the Malaysian rainforest, say, where we might hear the healing dance of the Temiar people, in which bamboo tubes are stamped on the ground in a pulsing echo of the cicada. Or on the open grasslands of North America, where the native people of the plains, the Blackfoot and the Sioux, who once hunted bison by driving herds into a ditch, might be heard singing cunningly in voices eerily like that of bleating calves. The Sioux, the Temiar and the Kaluli provide an acoustic flashback to our distant past. Tens of thousands of years ago, as hunter-gatherers, we moved stealthily through the undergrowth in search of prey, and any news of sightings would have had to be communicated. Like modern-day hunters in the bush, we'd almost certainly have done this by mimicking the animals, their walk, their movement, their cries. Gradually, this mimicry formed into the words we uttered. It's why animal names, even today, are often onomatopoeic. Try this experiment. Ask yourself which nonsense word would better describe the larger of two wooden tables, mil or mal? My guess is that you opted for mal. In most languages, we associate the I sound with small and the R sound with bigger things. Try another experiment. Which of these two words is a bird and which is a fish? Chanchatkit and mauts. Again, my guess is that you got it right. Chanchatkit just sounds like a bird, or rather, it sounds like a bird sounds. Something else that sounds like a bird. It's the ocarina. Its rich timbres have been heard for centuries in Central and South America, where it captures beautifully the melancholic, bluesy song of the native common potu bird. In some of the ancient civilizations of Mexico or the Andes, whole symbolic belief systems evolved which put sound right at their center. We can't be sure exactly when these traditions first evolved, but we can guess they have their roots far back in prehistory. Some of the oldest stone carvings in the region seem to illustrate breathing, speaking, singing, and echoing. Sound had mattered enough for people to have symbolized it for many generations. At no stage was this some abstract notion of sound. It was inspired by the real world, by the singing wilderness of nature. Humans have been just one section of the animal orchestra, adding their own layer to a bedrock of sounds caused by wind, sea, thunder, rain, and wildlife. But our ancestors would never be content just to copy nature. They also had more interesting ideas about how, with new architectural structures, they might actually manipulate sound and create entirely new dramatic effects, entirely new rituals.
Noise, a human history. A ritual soundscape.
Most of us probably think of Orkney as remote, Although only a few miles north of John O'Groats, it's always a ferry ride or a flight away from the Scottish mainland. But some 5,000 or so years ago, Orkney was, if only briefly, one of Europe's great centres of civilisation. Here, just a few feet from the North Atlantic, is Skara Brae, a stunningly preserved sunken village of walled houses, complete with stone furniture. Just a few miles southeast of here, two striking stone circles, Stennis and Brodgar, and close by, Mace Howe, a massive chambered tomb where, on the winter solstice, the setting sun sends a beam of light along a tiny passageway to illuminate its inner chamber. It's here that we can appreciate a fundamental shift in human history. By the Neolithic, our ancestors were no longer having to make do with caves or canyons or forests for their spiritual activities or for shelter. They were creating their own monumental buildings. These megaliths were almost certainly the centres of a complex ritual life, and they had their own human-made acoustic identity. We don't know whether the Neolithic monuments of Orkney, or anywhere else, were built especially in order to create new sound effects. It seems unlikely. But since the detritus of domestic occupation has never been found inside, we know that no one was living in them. These were out-of-the-ordinary places, where out-of-the-ordinary events took place. What kind of events we can only guess at. But the lesson of ethnography is that in most cultures, rituals are multisensual affairs. And when you enter one of Orkney's Neolithic sites, it certainly feels a bit like entering a theatre stage. If the people who built them noticed any striking sound effects, they must have been tempted to exploit them. But how exactly? Were these places for making a spectacular din, or places of silence and sensory deprivation? The first tantalising clues can be found here at the Ring of Brodgar. It's a stunning sight, a perfectly formed circle, about 100 metres or so across. 27 standing stones, some as much as 12 feet tall, all surrounded by a big circular ditch cut out of solid rock. Originally, there would have been about 60 stones standing here, enough to create an enclosed effect. If I move to the centre, it's possible in calm weather to just about detect distinct echoes ricocheting round the inside of the circle if I clap or shout loudly enough. The effect's even better if I beat a drum. The echoes should come back at me from all around the circle. If I move away from the centre, the effect lessens. And when I move to just outside the circle, the effect is lost. So part of the sense of occasion in being here might have been a theatrical shift as you entered the circle, from the ambient sounds of the natural world, the sounds of the sea and of the wind, to a range of more contained and controlled ceremonial sounds within. If we come to the chambered cairn at Mace Howe, we get a slightly different effect. This burial chamber is made of dry stone walling, covered with a big mound of clay, grass growing all over it. That's wonderful soundproofing. And even if there were people inside it right now, I think I'd be hard-pressed to hear their voices. But no cairn has ever been 100% soundproof. And experiments at sites very similar to here have shown something interesting. High-frequency sounds being trapped inside and low-frequency ones escaping. So if you were to do, say, drumming on the inside, someone standing outside nearby could hear something deeper. But this distorted rumble would probably be second rate as an experience compared with what might be being heard right at the chamber's hidden centre.
I'm just going to switch on the electrics and things, OK?
Now, the first thing I have to negotiate is what looks like a small passageway. Pretty neat. I'm having to crouch down quite a long way. And the walls are very, very neat. It's a very precise tunnel. The smell is changing and the temperature is a sort of earthier smell. But the thing that is most striking, an intense stillness is taking over. The sound from outside is almost vanishing. And it's almost as if shuffling along this long passageway, bent over, almost like a kind of show of respect. I've also been undergoing some sort of passage into another realm. Okay, let's keep going. And we're now in the very centre. It's square, not quite a cube, and the sound of the outside world has entirely vanished here. This would, I think, have been something new in human history. It was a handcrafted space of silence. Not that it would remain silent for long, I think. Simply being in this space, talking as I am now, even making any kind of bodily noise, such as walking about or whispering, introduces other possibilities. It would, for instance, be easy to use this artificial silence as a blank canvas on which I could create completely new soundscapes. So a chambered cairn like this, with its smooth, straight walls, is perfectly shaped for creating what's called a standing wave of sound, where sound folds back upon itself and builds up in complex layers. Listen what happens when I start to beat a single drum. Some archaeologists have noticed that the tonal frequency is a lot like the one that can send the human brain into a state about halfway between wakefulness and sleep, the state that prompts our strongest moments of vivid mental imagery, even hallucinations. There's something else being generated that we can't actually notice, which is ultra-low frequency infrasound. Now, this is something that can make us feel peculiar. And a few years ago, at a burial chamber not far from here, there were some volunteers who were exposed to short bursts of infrasound created by drumming. And what they reported was dizziness and, in some cases, a strange feeling of rising physically. Again, we don't know if any of this was an intentional part of the original Neolithic builders' designs, but we can imagine that those in charge of the rituals here would have delighted in these otherworldly qualities. We'll never know for sure whether these were places of noise or places of silence, but it's highly likely that whoever controlled them had a great deal of power. Not all and sundry would have been allowed inside a tomb like Meishau to experience its sights, smells and sounds. That access would have reflected and reinforced social hierarchies. We've no idea whether there were men or women in Neolithic Orkney who acted like priests, but there must have been people a bit like them, which is why we can hear there the first intimations of a new elite, professional gatekeepers of the spirit world, people who are learning how to manipulate sound in all sorts of wonderful and sometimes secretive ways to shape our religious beliefs.
You are listening to the BBC series Noise, a Human History.
Noise, a Human History. The Rise of the Shamans.
Sounds of men and sometimes women entering a trance-like state in an attempt to contact the spirit world. They're shamans, and they can still be found in all parts of the globe. A special caste of people claiming to be able to access a different level of consciousness and using either drugs or rhythmic music or both in order to reach the spirits, communicate with them, and return to their senses to heal the sick, control animals, change the weather. They've been found wherever there have been hunter-gatherer societies, from the Native Americans of California to the Inuit of Alaska, the San of South Africa, and the peoples of Inner Mongolia. The practice of achieving some kind of ecstatic state is even more widespread. One survey of nearly 500 different cultures showed at least 90% had shamanistic features. In the late Paleolithic and the Neolithic, that is, between about 20,000 and 4,000 years ago, many humans, like the reindeer herders of Siberia today, were still hunter-gatherers. If our prehistoric ancestors were beginning to develop a sacred life, there would have been among them a select group of people at least a bit like shamans. The drumming and incantations of living shamans, often in darkened spaces, would have comfortably fitted a Stone Age society dominated by a rich array of supernatural beliefs. So one obvious question is this: were shaman-like people using sound to wield power and influence over their fellow human beings? Listen closely to what happens when a shaman enters a trance. Here's an old account from Valdemar Bogoras, a young Russian writer who'd been exiled to Siberia by the Tsar. Bogoras devoted himself to studying the Chukchi, who herded reindeer across Russia's northeast wilderness. He noticed how skillfully the shaman could deploy sound to create a richly suggestive atmosphere, especially at night.
After the evening meal is finished and the kettles and trays are removed to the outer tent, all the people who wish to be present at the seance enter the inner room, which is carefully closed for the night.
When everyone's inside, the lamps are extinguished and the shaman lights his pungent tobacco.
He beats the drum and sings his introductory tunes, at first in a low voice, then soon it fills the small, closed-up room with its violent clamor. The narrow walls resound in all directions. The shaman uses his drum for modifying his voice, now placing it directly before his mouth, now turning it at an oblique angle, and all the time beating it violently. After a few minutes, all this noise begins to work strangely on the listeners. They lose the power to locate the source of the sounds, and, almost without any effort of imagination, the song and the drum seem to shift from corner to corner, to move about without having any definite place at all.
It's as if the room is alive with spirits flying through the air.
The separate voices are at first faint, as if coming from afar. As they gradually approach, they increase in volume, and at last they rush into the room, pass through it and out, dying away in the remote distance. Other voices come from above, pass through the room and seem to go underground, where they are heard as if from the depths of the earth.
Mm, 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 mm.
The effects this shaman achieved, with the help of some basic acoustical principles, and by creating a suggestive atmosphere in that tiny, overheated space, are really striking. Bogoras spoke to Chukchi people who said they knew that the shaman's tricks were by no means real. Like some modern-day spiritualists, they made generous use in the darkness of human assistance. Yet the Chukchi loved the performances. For them, spirits were always lurking, ready to be released, but they were usually invisible. They could only really be experienced through being heard. Sound as the means of reaching a spiritual world has been a remarkably pervasive feature of human culture for thousands of years. But these ancient forms of trance have long since been domesticated, and we've come to experience them in terms of our own particular cultures and religions. So even in utterly familiar rituals, we might be hearing remnants of earlier practices. There's a lovely example of acoustic trickery which bears an uncanny similarity to the shaman's practice of throwing voices from medieval Christendom. It's still performed as part of an elaborate ritual in one English cathedral city. This is Wells Cathedral, and I'm standing in front of the West Front, which is extraordinary. It's like a cliff wall, 100 feet high, 150 feet wide, and on it, hundreds of statues of kings and bishops and saints and apostles and angels arranged in niches from top to bottom and side to side. And they tell a story, it's the Bible story, but it's really the overall effect which is striking, especially if you think that about 800 years ago when this was first made, this entire West Front would have been painted in vivid colours of red and green and gold gilding. It was clearly designed as a visual spectacle, a showpiece. But what is most interesting about this facade is the way in which it comes to life once a year on Palm Sunday, and it's Palm Sunday today. The congregation are assembled quietly outside, and a procession of the cathedral's choir and clergy stop right next to them and begin singing the introit from Psalm 24.
Earth is the Lord's and all that fills it.
The next line comes not from any of the choristers standing right in front of the congregation, but from a disembodied voice floating down from somewhere up on the facade itself. It's mysterious. None of the congregation standing on the ground outside can see anyone up on the facade. The ethereal voice seems, in fact, to be coming from one of the angels that are set in niches about a third of the way up the West Front. It's as though this particular angel has been singing to the congregation, as though the angel itself is alive. It's a wonderful auditory illusion. And the secret behind this singing angel is only revealed if you leave the congregation and the choir, go under the West Front's facade, and enter the cathedral itself.
We're going through a door into what seems like a very well concealed passage between the wall of the West Front outside and the wall of the nave inside, climbing carefully up some circular steps. An even smaller passage with the sign, danger, keep out. And here we are, and it suddenly got colder, and there are in front of me three large holes. They're shaped rather like megaphones, and it's pretty clear that what they're designed for is not looking out of, but actually singing out of. And these holes are positioned exactly at the height of the statues of the angels on the West Front.
It's precisely here, today on Palm Sunday, that one of the choristers was secretly positioned to create the illusion for those standing on the ground outside of an angel in full voice.